Well, thanks for having me. I'll be here actually just through tomorrow. So before I leave tomorrow, I might tell you about the following. So we talked about probing yesterday, and I figured emphasizing some aspects of my work recently that have to do with probing properties of cold atoms may be apt. Also, it's what we're doing other than doing spinner condensates, and I'm planning on coming to speak about that during the conference that's being held in April, so I won't talk about it. If you would like, I could talk about how we image the magnetization and then refrain from showing you any interesting results. So it's your choice. But let's review one of the common ways in which information has been gleaned from cold atoms for a while now, certainly in the Bose systems, and I imagine also increasingly in the Fermi systems. In the Fermi systems, as we talked about yesterday, to some degree getting at, if you're just, you can ask whether you want to be looking at single particle features or features of pairs specifically. I don't see any reason why Bragg scattering wouldn't work for, let's say, the pairs, because after all, they do form a molecule, and the molecules will scatter light as well. So Bragg scattering of pairs should also be possible. But anyhow, the idea with either Bragg or Raman scattering, to some degree, it's similar to neutron scattering and condensed matter systems, except that one does it using coherent beams of the incoming particles, which you don't have the option of doing with neutrons. So you take a gas of cold atoms, and you send upon it perhaps a pair of laser beams with differing momenta and different energies. And as a result of being exposed to this pair of laser beams, the atoms may choose to accept the particular momentum difference and energy difference between the two photons. And if they do so, there will be some experimental signatures of having done it. There'll be a conversion of atoms, perhaps from one internal state to another in the case of Raman scattering. There can also be a transfer of atoms from one momentum class to another momentum class. And this momentum class may be high enough in momentum or in energy to leave the system, in which case one is doing the equivalent of photoelectron spectroscopy. Or it may reside within the system and you just see the system heat up in some manner. You also have the photons emitted, because if an atom has accepted a pair of, has rescattered photons so as to accept this momentum and this energy, then the rescattered photons will appear as a redistribution of photons between the two beams. And so by placing detectors that look at the light rather than look at the atoms, you can also gather that information. This is more akin to neutron scattering, where you look at the outgoing neutrons rather than looking to see that the crystal that you've exposed to the neutrons has recoiled or spin flipped. And here's an example of a Bragg spectroscopy, the way it was done back in the last century. And so happens to be a Bose condensate held inside of a trap. It was exposed to a pair of laser beams for a short period of time. And after exposure to those laser beams, the atoms were released from their trap. And you could see the transfer of atoms from the momentum classes that comprise the condensate into some other momentum classes that are distinguishable in time of flight. So they just separate quite clearly, and you can count this population, which quantifies the response of the system at a particular momentum transfer and a particular energy transfer. You obtain a line shape, which we always do in atomic physics, and then you interpret that line shape and the line shift as being reflective of some properties of the cold atomic system. And that line shape is related to the structure factor in the system. If this is Bragg scattering, it's just the scalar structure factor. If it's Raman scattering, it also involves a spin flip, so it tells you about spin relations within the gas. And so there's a lot of information in this line shape, and on different regimes you will use it to interpret different things about your cloud. But from my naive point of view, I would say that you can roughly distinguish between two different regimes in which you're examining Bragg scattering. At small momentum transfers, maybe when you're just changing momenta but within the range of momenta inhabited by the system, you might expect that you're sensitive to the ways in which the particles arrange themselves in those momentum classes. So it gets at the correlations that are within the system. At very high momentum, though, you're ejecting particles from the system, and you may then be exploring the single particle-like excitations of the system, free of the weak interactions between particles and just going to the regular behavior of propagating atoms. Reflective of this distinction is the fact that under certain circumstances you can write, let's say, the width of the line. There's also expressions for the shift of the line, but the width of the line that one saw in Bragg scattering from Bose gases was related to the sum of two widths. One was reflective of the interactions between particles. In the case of Bragg scattering, you're getting an interaction energy due to exchange terms. In Raman scattering, you would get an interaction energy in case there's a difference in scattering lengths. And you're also sensitive to the Doppler distribution of the gas, and that just adds us another width. And you can change which of these widths is emphasized, since this Doppler width grows with the wave vector that you transfer to the system. So when one wanted, in that previous experiment that I showed you, the focus was on this term, and one could measure, for example, the momentum width of a trapped condensate, which is certainly different than the momentum width of a condensate that's been released from its trap, where all of this energy has been turned into momentum, and you can't actually tell that there was anything coherent to start with.
But how do you get omega information out of it? So the decay information is...
Yeah. So again, what you would have done in neutron scattering is you would have sent in this beam of neutrons. You would have looked at these scattered neutrons and done spectroscopy on them. Here you do it a priori by setting the energy difference and asking for a stimulated emission event. So the energy difference, the energy that you're probing, is specified by this frequency difference in the beams.
And then you just count the number of atoms.
And then you look at response in some manner. You look at how much momentum's been transferred to the cloud. You look at how much the system heats up after the momentum's been rethermalized. You look at the ejection of atoms or the spin flips of atoms. Or you look at the redistribution of light between beams. So,
can you monitor that the number of photons you can get the full sort of distribution can you actually count the number of photons which have been transferred from one to the other?
Yeah, to an extent. If it's above the photon shot noise, then yes. So spectroscopy's in atomic physics always work by two techniques. One is the Rabi interferometer technique, where you expose the system to a resonant drive and you look at its response. The other one is the Ramsey technique of separated oscillatory fields, so a pair of Rabi experiments. So you expose the system to a resonant drive, you wait, you expose it again, and then you look at the cumulative response. And the benefit of this kind of Ramsey system is that in this evolution period between a first pulse and a second pulse, in this kind of pump probe spectroscopy, the system is presumably freely evolving. So the evolution of the system is free from the exposure to light and other things that you might have done to perturb it. Here's an example from Bill Phillips's group where they applied this Bragg scattering technique in a pump probe method. So they have a first pulse of light, they wait, and they have a second pulse of light, and they can see an oscillation in the response of the system, which is reflective of the coherence of the system during this evolution time. And given this, they can, for example, or they could extract coherence lengths inside of their gas just by looking at the amplitude of these oscillations, just like one does in nuclear magnetic resonance or other places where you apply this technique.
So what is measured here? What is probed here? So you send a pulse which excites the system?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then the second pulse measures what?
So yeah. Right. So this might be understood as an atom interferometer also. So I have my initial system, and I hit it with the first pulse of light, which maybe I should regard as creating a replica of my system, but one which is moving, boosted in momentum.
Okay.
Now a second pulse comes along, and whether the second pulse adds population to that upper level, or reduces it back down to the ground state, or just does something neutral, depends on the coherence between the two pieces. So it's sort of an autocorrelation of the wave function.
But I don't understand what is probed. It's the intensity of absorbed light, or?
And then here they happen to be looking again at the population of atoms that are transferred, the net transfer of atoms as a consequence of these two pulses.
Okay.
So the two pulses, there's a phase that's evolving. There's an energy difference between the non-excited and the excited state atoms, and that energy difference shows up as a sinusoidal signal in time here, the delay time. And from that, you gather the...
So
I guess what I don't get is, what is the signal which is measured
here? I'm sorry. Okay, so here's their raw data, and these are atoms at zero momentum, and these are atoms at excited momentum.
This is the N of K, essentially.
This is a time of flight measure. Yeah. So, roughly it's N of K.
Okay, let's say time of flight.
Okay, so it's counting the net number of atoms that have been scattered out. And these oscillations are equivalent to the line shift and line width that we saw in the previous graph. The line width will cause these things to damp out as a function of time, and the line width or the line shift will give us this oscillation frequency.
So just to be clear, so if I draw a line horizontally, I pass through all these dots. So basically, for any energy, so any dot in this curve, and then you take a photograph, and the photograph, I mean, after this sequence of pulses, and that photograph is are these three blocks.
Yeah, they happen to be doing it in both directions at once because it was convenient to them. But they count, you know, this population versus this pot, or I can't remember. Maybe it was a ratio of these two because there was a control in it. Anyhow, so the point is that you can do a pump probe spectroscopy rather than just a constant resonance spectroscopy, and you gather the same information.
Why are there sometimes two spots?
This is the method they chose. They wanted to calibrate their signal. So this was actually a four-pulse sequence, and the first bit just counted the intensity of their light, which was fluctuating. Okay. Bragg scattering actually doesn't require this second laser beam at all. You can rely on it to be created by the sample itself. And there was a nice observation that there is a nonlinear optical effect in which the system creates by itself the light which is required to cause Bragg scattering or Raman scattering. So what happens in some picture is that as light enters the system and the atoms start scattering light, even though the scattered photons leave the system quite quickly, the recoiling atoms, or the changed atoms, reside in the system for a rather long period of time, because their recoil velocity is just a centimeter per second or so. That means that when the next photons come around and they're making the decision in which direction to be rescattered, they can be Bose stimulated by the presence of particles in the final state. Bose stimulated is actually a charged word because it works also in Fermi gases and in thermal gases. But anyhow, there's some kind of collective stimulation of light in directions that in which light has been previously emitted. And as a result of all of that, you can end up with light spontaneously coming out of the system, which has exactly a certain k vector and frequency, which matches some resonance within the system. So superradiance, if you will, is a form of Bragg scattering in the end. The superradiance bit of it is the magic that it comes out of just stimulated emission, out of just spontaneous emission. But afterwards, it's just a collective scattering phenomenon, which is not so unusual. Okay. So here's how superradiance was observed in these systems. Let's say you take a long cold gas. It can be Bose condensed or not, as you wish, and you shine in just a single laser beam. Now, photons scatter willy-nilly out of this gas, but eventually there's a strongest stimulation for photons to accumulate in these end-fire modes. So the predominant form of optical scattering eventually becomes a very directed beam of light, which... how should we regard what's happening in the system? Imagine that after this first beam of light has entered the gas, some photons have been scattered off in this direction. If we look back at the gas and see how has the gas changed in response to this light scattering, well, now you have the original system, but you also have a replica of the system which is recoiling with the number of atoms in it matching the number of photons that have been scattered up in this direction. The interference, if you will, between these two portions of atoms can create a density grating, or in the case of Raman scattering, a polarization grating, which looks like a diffraction grating for light. So the next, as the beam of light runs through the sample now, it sees this diffraction grating, which is perfectly tuned to scatter further light in the same direction as previously scattered light. So in this collective response, the system builds up its own density grating and rescatters light collectively. And you can see that in a number of ways. You can examine the light that's sent out of the system. So you see suddenly a burst of light in a much shorter time than you would have expected given just single particle scattering. You can also see correlations that build up in momentum space which differ from what you would expect based on uncorrelated light scattering. Those are the signals that tell you that superradiance has occurred.
Is there a delay? So, because you need time to build up this gradient.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a bit of a delay, and there's sort of an exponential rise time here.
I didn't understand. What's the scale for the gradient?
So the grating length is exact. So it's the interference between the stationary and moving atoms. The moving atoms have a certain amount of recoil due to the exchange of momenta, and that sets the scale.
Because that preferred mode must come from.
So what's that?
The preferred scattering direction has to come from some property of
it. Yeah. So if the system is spherical, then actually all modes are amplified at once.
Right.
So you get a super fluorescence. Which still leads to enhanced fluorescence, but doesn't give you anything so directed. If you have an asymmetric sample like this, then there are preferred directions.
And does it come out the other end?
Yeah. It pops out both ends.
Oh, it comes out at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as a function of temperature, how does it work? This work for normal gas also?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll show you some data.
I don't remember that. At that time, were there experiments done on fermions also? Or only
no, but it'll work. Since it works above TC, it'll work for fermions.
Sure.
All right. So now this, the fact that superradiance occurs is, during superradiance, this grating, let's say, builds up, this due to the nonlinear optics. But at the same time, there are mechanisms that cause this grating to cease to become effective in rescattering light. And these mechanisms are the ones that we were talking about wanting to get at previously. Something to do with correlations in the system and something to do with the Doppler width of the system. So for example, it is possible that I would have a density grating which is established either artificially or through this kind of light scattering event. But then over time, it's possible that this grating would dephase. That is, maybe there would be, it would evolve at a frequency which is higher at one end of the cloud than the other end of the cloud. And that would be due to inhomogeneous shifts in the cloud, due to mean field interactions, due to correlations between position and momentum, or due to Zeeman shifts or other things going on. And then, of course, the grating cannot necessarily stretch out and become not mode matched anymore, but it can also just decay away. And it would decay away because of various sort of homogeneous broadenings. Collisions between atoms can take you out of these favored momentum states. There can be a homogeneous Doppler width associated with the temperature, and so on. So if we look at the decay or dephasing of this grating, we also gather really the same information we had gotten in Bragg scattering. And here's this was developed by a group in Japan as a mode of spectroscopy. So what they did was they did a pump probe superradiance experiment. First, they initiate superradiance. So the equations of motion here are very fast so that you can ignore the decay for now. And then you allow the system to evolve freely. And the decay of the grating, let's say, is associated with some property of the gas, in this case with a coherence length. And then they pulse on the second beam, and they see whether the grating is still effective at scattering light. Very similar to the Bragg scattering pump probe experiment, except it just involved one laser beam. So here are the data. Again, a first pump comes in, establishes superradiance. And if you look at the light coming out, you see this exponential rise that I spoke about. And then we wait a little while, or they wait a little while, and a second pulse comes in and checks to see whether the system still has this collective response. If the system had not decayed any between the first pulse and the second, the second trace would just be a continuation of the first. But the fact that it's extinguished or diminished in height is reflective of the fact that there's been some decoherence of this grating. In particular, this was due to the Doppler shifts, to the temperature of the cloud, to the presence of a coherence length of finite range. And by varying this pulse separation between the pump and probe, they can really map out the correlation function in space. So this is similar probably to what Tilman Esslinger has spoken about, where they measure it with this RF slicing technique. But here it's done by this optical technique. And you can see in a thermal gas, you have a decay down to zero over some length scale associated with a temperature. In a condensate, you have a decay down to some finite value. This is the very long coherence of a condensate, on top of which there's this very short coherence of the thermal cloud at finite temperature.
How do you get the length out there?
The recoil. So you know the recoil velocity and connect it with the distance. So what's left to do? It struck us that all these methods were not allowing us to understand the behavior of inhomogeneous gases. So there will be situations, for example, where the coherence properties of the gas might be spatially varying for various reasons. Maybe it's the shells around these mod insulator islands where you expect a superfluid shell. Maybe it's some quench or some first order transition which gives you little puddles of superfluid within an uncondensed or within a normal state. Or maybe you also have systems where just by looking, let's say, at momentum width, you missed an important feature of the system. So maybe if you look at, let's say, in phase space, you look at the Wigner function or how the wave function of the atoms look, you might have a system which has a pretty large Doppler width given the size of the cloud, and yet is actually so highly correlated that it actually occupies a very, very small volume of phase space and is therefore highly coherent. And if you just do your rough measurements of spatial distribution and momentum distribution, you would miss out on this important feature. So those are things we've addressed using superradiance. The first was dealing with inhomogeneity in the system and turning superradiance into an in situ imaging technique. And the idea is quite simple. We'd been looking at time of flight pictures after superradiance, or maybe we've been looking at light coming out of the atoms during superradiance, but we had been ignoring this important signal that there's light propagating through the gas. And if we just image that light, we might see something striking about the system. So let's say we have a partly condensed Bose gas, which was just our test case here. You take a normal image of it, which just measures the density inside the trap. You see that there's a lump in the center which has somewhat higher density, and you associate that with a condensate through your usual arguments. But what you're seeing there is just an energetic difference between the condensate and the thermal cloud. You don't really see directly that the condensate has any coherence to it. You're not measuring coherence length whatsoever. On the other hand, as I told you earlier, the grating that's established here by superradiance is sensitive to coherence within the gas. It's, after all, some autocorrelation of a wave function which has been displaced from its origin. And so if we look at the light coming out of a superradiating cloud, we might set up a condition where only the condensate superradiates and the rest of the gas, because it has a short coherence length, does not superradiate. And then in this nonlinear absorption image, you would end up with a very definite description of where the condensate lies, and indeed a measurement of its coherence length performed in situ. So the way we do that is we expose our system as before to a pump probe sequence. Actually, we do pump probe, 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 just because it's convenient. And we insert this gap time between the first pulse and the second pulse. And in order to selectively image atoms of a certain coherence length, we set the time between pulses as being long enough for atoms with a short coherence length to dephase away. And so only the atoms with only the coherent portion of the gas, coherent beyond some coherence length, will show up in our images. And here's a sequence of these coherence-enhanced images. This is a sequence of these, you know, direct absorption images taken above TC and below TC. So you can see clearly above TC, where there's no coherent gas, there's nothing to see, because there's not enough coherence to cause superradiance. And below TC, you see a darkening of the cloud in the area which is occupied by the condensate. So it's a nonlinear optical effect, a nonlinear absorption of light, and it happens selectively in the condensed portion. This is maybe a little more clear in the following, where we, in these previous images, we can just ask ourselves in this total sequence of images, how many photons are missing in a given pixel if we just sum over all the frames of the image. And if we take that, this is the first pulse, the second pulse, the third pulse, we image all of them. Okay. And the fact that there is some odd spatial structure here where the tips look dark first and the center looks dark later has to do with the physics of superradiance in extended samples, which actually had not been observed before.
That's understood at the moment.
Well, I don't know. We kind of understand it, but so it's a property of superradiance, and simple models of superradiance miss this. But it was always there. One never had a chance to see it, though.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you see any black dot in the first two or three pictures? What do you mean?
Yeah, so in this first pulse, we set up this density grating, which we start superradiance, but then it dephases, because the atoms move by more than a coherence length, and so there's no interference.
Okay. In the right, in B.
Here, okay, so here, here we set up the grating, but it's still weak. We amplify it more, it's still weak. We amplify it enough that it finally shows up as enough. So here, you know, here the absorption is enhanced more than a factor of 10 above what it would be just for linear absorption. And it takes a while for the modulation depth in this grating to be deep enough to scatter that much light. So anyhow, if we just sum over all these frames on a pixel by pixel basis, then we can see spatially where the condensate resides. So this is a comparison of in situ images of just the normal density, or of the total density, versus the specific images of the condensate density. And for example, in a comparison right here and right here, you can see that we're able to selectively image with some degree of precision the condensed portion rather than the uncondensed portion. Okay, so that allows us to measure coherence in situ. And I think this method is in many ways quite similar to what Esslinger spoke about, where he was extracting atoms from two particular slices, and he wanted to look at the coherence here versus the coherence here versus the coherence here. And here we can do the same thing. We can ask ourselves, what is the coherence length at this piece of the cloud, or in this piece of the cloud, or in this piece of the cloud? And again, we're able to determine that. Not that it's such an interesting comparison for a system as simple as this. Okay, so this other bit about probing systems in which position and momentum are highly correlated, that's something that we developed in a different context, where we thought about atom interferometers. And so that's one of the goals in my research group, is to build atom interferometers and perform measurements of something other than condensed matter physics and cold atoms. And, stuff of lasting value. Anyhow, in these atom interferometers, here's what's going to happen. Either the atom interferometers operate by sending atoms through free space, or maybe more ambitiously, one sets up narrow waveguides, essentially like optical fibers, and sends the atoms through these. And the benefit of that would be that you could maybe orchestrate more complicated interferometers, or maybe you could have atoms integrating up over long periods of time, or large areas, or whatnot, because they're guided around in interesting shapes. When we build these atom interferometers, we may start off with a coherent object that we send through the interferometer, but this is a self-interacting coherent object. And what happens to it when it gets injected into these waveguides and propagates through the interferometer vis-a-vis its coherence is not really very certain. people had seen that the first types of guided interferometers that were built were quite poor. And there are some aspects of how atoms expand into the waveguide that turned out to distort the wavefront so that coherence couldn't be ascertained in a simple manner. We've also seen in our experiments that as atoms propagate through waveguides that are slightly corrugated, you can end up with pretty wild motion of the guided beam. People have seen this in other experiments as well, and that could certainly spell doom for the coherence that you're trying to examine. And maybe most interesting is the fact that, of course, in one-dimensional systems, coherence is a pretty fragile thing. If the system were to rethermalize it, maybe it expands into a guide going from a three-dimensional to a one-dimensional configuration. But in that one-dimensional configuration, we may not expect long-range coherence. So at what point does that kind of thermal effect or that one-dimensional effect set in? When it does, then to some extent, our atom interferometers are useless. So these are things that we certainly would like to examine. In particle physics, they know how to diagnose particle beams quite well. And what they do is they use what they call a pepper pot technique. And it's quite simple. If you have a beam and you want to characterize its emittance at this particular location, you send it through two screens. And the first screen has a little slit in it that specifies X. And the second screen, further down downstream, you measure the distribution of particles, and that measures the momentum of the particles coming out of that first hole. And as you scan that hole across the beam and you collect information, you eventually build up information about the phase space distribution of a beam, and then you can tune up your storage ring to give you the right distribution. For the quantum gases, we can also talk about the phase space distribution. We just have to be careful to talk about the Wigner function, which will account for the fact that there is coherence in the beam, and it's given as follows. It characterizes the single particle density matrix of the wave function of a system.
Can you explain again for the Kepler plot? So the reason that you get a distribution is you fix x this direction, or x is this direction.
You scan across x, and this is part of, why do you want to know this? So you can just leak particles out of here and then see where they go.
And that will give you, this grid will give you px.
Yeah.
And then I see.
Yeah, and this is fine in classical physics. Okay. To measure the Wigner function, you have to do things related but somewhat different. So the Wigner function is a function that lies in phase space. So for one dimension, it lies in this two-dimensional plane of position and momentum. And maybe the task before us is to tell the difference between this round distribution and this elliptical distribution. These are two distributions that have the same momentum width and the same position width, but they certainly have much different coherence because one of them occupies a very narrow slice of phase space density. And the way you can tell the difference between them is not just by measuring position and momentum, which are two particular projections of the Wigner function, but actually by measuring the Wigner function at all projection angles, something called tomography. And if you can somehow make a measurement of the projection of that Wigner function along all angles, then you can reconstruct the Wigner function of arbitrary complexity. Here it's a rather simple one where it's just Gaussian but squished. Incidentally, if you just do time of flight on a correlated distribution like this, and you vary the time of flight, you can map out this portion of the projection angles, but not this important portion, where this dip in the width of this cloud is most evident. You know, the fact that it has one very narrow dimension. All right.
So why time of flight cannot access that region?
It can't, because the cloud just shears further. And you don't, it just gets wider, doesn't get narrow. You sort of need to go backwards in time to see it. Mm-hmm. Just time reverse.
Oh, I see, when you altogether.
Yeah. So we developed a spectroscopic method for doing this, and again, it's relying on superradiance. And it's a bichromatic pump probe spectroscopy in the following sense. We have a difference in K vectors defining the two beams of light. Here one of them is actually generated by the medium itself, but it doesn't matter. Two beams of light intersect, and they, when exposed to a gas of atoms, they will create a density modulation with a certain wave vector. Okay, so in a gas which is chirped, as I showed you before, where position and momentum are correlated, this density modulation itself will change in time. It'll expand with the cloud. And what that means effectively is that if we probe it with the same wave vectors which created the density modulation to begin with, there's now a mismatch in phase. Which is to say that if we're just measuring the momentum distribution, which is what the pump probe spectroscopy of old did, then you can't resolve this narrow dimension of the chirped cloud. But if you just tailor your beams so that they're checking the right wave vector, so that they're following the chirp of the gas, then you can actually detect that there's high coherence in this particular gas. So effectively, as you vary the difference in wave vectors between your pump and your probe and other parameters in the system, you're able to project along a specific angle in phase space, and you can vary this experimentally as you will. So it's.
So how do you adjust the difference in K that follows the phasing?
Yeah.
You don't know what it is a priori.
Well, okay, you don't know what it is a priori, so you try all of them.
Huh?
You try all of them. You make projections of all angles in phase space.
But the phasing also depends change in time. So
yeah, so you have to tune that also with the delay time.
Oh, I see. We have a lot of trial and error things.
Well, you map out the entire thing. Uh-huh. Our test bed for this was atoms propagating in a circular waveguide. which I won't say much about, except we can create a gas of atoms in a portion of this waveguide, and we can then, this is a coherent gas, and then we can send it along, and as it rotates around the guide, it expands, and it goes into this one-dimensional regime, we know that. And we see that the gas expands as it's rotating around the ring, so we know its momentum distribution, but we don't know whether that momentum distribution still retains coherence, or whether it's just equivalent to a thermal gas at the same temperature associated with that expansion. So that's something that we have to determine experimentally. In this, so the way we do it is by using the curved waveguide itself to tune the first pulse and second pulse so as to look at a particular angle in phase space. So the experiment's very simple, the interpretation isn't. The atoms are spinning around the waveguide, and at a particular location in the waveguide, we expose them to two pulses of light, the pump and the probe. And after a long while, the atoms which have scattered light, in this case they've backscattered light, so they've been boosted in the forward direction, the atoms that have scattered light separate physically from the atoms that haven't scattered light, and so we can count the fraction of atoms that have rescattered this light. Now, it might be confusing where the tuning is in this system. The tuning comes from the fact that the atoms are rotating. So the atoms in our rotating waveguide, when they see the first pulse, they see light, let's say, coming in from some direction at them, and they scatter out along the long axis of the cloud. Okay? That means that that's what the superradiance gives you, and it gives you a transfer of momentum given by this quantity Q1.
Excuse me, I just understand the situation. So, is the waveguide itself rotating, or you deposit angular momentum and let it go after? So what is
the waveguide is round.
It's round.
And the atoms have been pushed, so we've launched them.
But in the experiment, the waveguide itself is stationary, and then
yeah. Rotating. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So as the atoms rotate by at a certain rotation rate, what happens is that when they see the second pulse of light coming at them, it comes in from a different angle, essentially. And that means that when you're checking for superradiance after having established it in the first pulse, you're checking at a different wave vector than the original, the wave vector in which you deposited this coherence. And that then allows you to relate parameters of the experiment, such as the rotation rate and the initial position of the cloud in the ring, to this projection angle. And again, you're able to look at all angles. And the result is here. So this is kind of like in the pump probe spectroscopy that was done in Kuka's group. There was the first pulse, you wait a little while, there was a second pulse, and we're looking at sort of the total scattering from the pair of pulses. And when things are coherent, that sum is large. So at some uninteresting angle in the ring, we see a rapid decay with the delay time between the pump and the probe. This is reflective of the overall momentum distribution of the gas. But when we tune it to this particular angle in phase space, we see much longer coherence, which is reflective of this very narrow dimension in phase space. And from these measurements, we reconstruct this specific Wigner function, which, as you can imagine, is highly correlated. And we're able to place an experimental bound on this particular system that it occupies 9 phase space cells or fewer. So it's something in the direction of checking that it's still coherent. But in terms of accumulating the probes that you can use to probe systems, here's a way to probe something that's not position, it's not momentum, it's a particular combination of the two.
So what determines the coherence in the experiment? How does how does the system lose coherence?
Oh, no. This is just an experimental bound, so it's probably 1. We just couldn't tell. So, and as usual, you know, when things are, the gas was maybe 300 microns long, it was hard to see that it was a coherence length of 300 microns. Let me talk about means to detect fluctuations. This is an experiment where just starting to set up, but you heard Tillman Esslinger speak, so you kind of know what I'm going to talk about. It would be very interesting to be able to measure, let's say, the number of atoms in a particular location extremely accurately. For example, maybe what's actually in here is some coherent state, or maybe some more interesting correlated state of atom number. Maybe it's a number squeeze state that's produced in a mod insulator phase, or maybe it's a phase squeeze state, which would be produced if you change the scattering length, and so on and so forth. So how can we determine that? Well, you can count the number of atoms in a particular location actually with single atom accuracy, right? I mean, I know that I have five fingers. That's not a problem. The problem is I want to perhaps make that measurement non-destructively. That is, I want the system afterwards, I want to make a non-demolition measurement which allows the system, other than the fact that it's been projected by my measurement, to otherwise continue to evolve. And that is a stricter criterion, a much stricter criterion. So you can phrase the question in, you know, some particularly simple physical realization, and you get the following result. Maybe one way in which you'll count the number of atoms here, or it could be a difference in the number of atoms because you're measuring spin. Anyhow, to measure this number, perhaps you're going to measure the index of refraction of this gas. That is, you're going to send light through it, and at the output, you're going to measure the phase shift on the light through some kind of homodyne or heterodyne technique. Well, the more light I send in, the better are my photon counting statistics, and the more precision I get on my measurement. At the same time, the more light I send in, the more rescattering the atoms do, the more they rescatter light. And it's okay if they rescatter in some deterministic way, that I know, for example, that exactly 5% of my atoms disappear from my system. But of course, that 5% is uncertain by the square root of that 5%, because the losses are uncorrelated. And so there's an undetermined change in the population of the gas, and that spoils my measurement. And so I have to balance this, and at the optimal total fluence of light through the system, I end up being able to measure non-destructively the number of atoms with this particular precision. I can measure below shot noise, so this would be the shot noise limit on the atoms, the square root of the number of atoms. But I can't measure much below shot noise. Now maybe I'm particularly greedy, and I want this delta N actually not to be some small suppression below shot noise, but I actually want to measure at the single particle level, but to do so non-destructively. Well, then I can't.
But finally, you want N to be 1.
I want delta N to be 1 for N not 1.
Right.
And that can't be done in free space. That's the result.
Oh, but before you proceed, so you say you can measure below shot noise usually. So usually, what technique you use to.
Yeah, so you can measure below shot noise just by this particular technique. Uh-huh. And the level to which you can measure below shot noise is 1 over the fourth root of the optical density.
I see. That's what
okay, and that's what this expression is. But in free space, I can't get the optical density per atom to be larger than 1, and so I can't count at the single particle level. Now, things change if I add a high finesse cavity around these atoms. And the balance of things is such now that even a single atom can represent an optical density which is very large. The very large is quantified by this number, which is the cooperativity, which is related to properties of atoms and cavities. And when you're in the strong coupling limit of cavity quantum electrodynamics, the single atom cooperativity is larger than 1. And in that case, you are able to count at the Heisenberg limit, at the 1-by-1 limit, for atom numbers which are larger than 1. So in particular, in our experiment, where this cooperativity is on the order of 100, one in principle should be able to count at the single atom level, non-destructively, up to around 100 atoms, before you're uncertain whether it's 99 or 100. So that's motivation for people to stuff cavities full of atoms. Because if I have an interesting many-body quantum system in here, I can make interesting measurements on it. And I can develop, if you will, the quantum optics of the matter wave field.
I missed it. What is this enhanced factor coming from?
Okay. So when we place this high finesse cavity in here, the light bounces many times back and forth through the atoms. So the atoms see it more often, so they can scatter it more often, but the net balance is that you increase your sensitivity to the atoms in the cavity. So
I see. So when the light bounces,
this here is the finesse of the cavity. This is the number of times it bounces back, light bounces back and forth before it finally leaks out. And so you get an improvement here where, you know, the finesse comes into this expression.
But somehow it's not affecting the other factors. I mean, you're still counting.
Yeah.
The band comes from the shot noise, right?
Okay, so this expression, so, you know, again, on one hand, you decrease the variance of your measurement with more light. On the other hand, you increase the variance with more light. Now you optimize that sum of the variances, and you get this expression for how noisy it is at optimum. You repeat that calculation for a high finesse cavity, and you get the following.
Because so, the scatter rate changes things less.
So. Essentially, the light sees.
Which factor is it? I'm just in terms of which balancing factor changes.
Both are changed. But, it's as if basically you have your n atoms, but you actually have the finesse times n. You have the finesse copies of them. So the finesse is 500,000. Then I have 500,000 times these atoms that light is experiencing. And so clearly this n of that the light passes through is now a large number. But of course the number of atoms that I'm counting is still the same number as before.
Oh.
If you will, that's what it is. The many mirror images of the same system. Okay.
The quality of cavity improve, then you improve this.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah, exactly.
Is there an intrinsic limit that you?
Is there an intrinsic limit to how good your cavity is? No.
No, I see.
No. I mean, there's technical limits, but there aren't intrinsic limits.
But there's a limit. There's the ultimate high single limit you increase rate. But here, But the question whether I can get it better than 1/1.
Yeah. So this will be, this can be 1, when n and c are equal. Because then it's the square root of n over the square root of n.
So I need to ask you.
So what's a typical finesse?
A typical finesse, well, is maybe a million or so.
Okay.
And the single atom cooperativity on the order of 100. Well, it depends on the cavity technology you're using. There are some cavities that are coming online that are even higher than that. Although it's not really clear how to get atoms in there. But here's a somewhat conventional cavity. And these experiments are formed in a vacuum chamber, which I won't care to show you. But there's some magnetic coils around. They kind of obscure our view. But we take two highly reflective mirrors, and we slide them in so that they're spaced by just a couple of hundred microns. And that forms our high finesse cavity. And I'll show you images of atoms in this particular field of view. So the way this experiment works is over there in the ocean, we produce a bunch of cold atoms, and we slowly bring them over. We transfer them over to this location, where the rest you can see for yourself. The atoms there are placed in a magnetic trap. They're evaporated until the cloud is kind of small. They're translated into the cavity. Now they reside within the mode, which is established by these high finesse mirrors, or these high reflectivity mirrors that face each other. And what we've been doing in our recent experiments is not working with magnetically trapped atoms, but working with optically trapped atoms. And so the optical trap is actually formed in exactly the same volume as where the atoms will be probed. So the total sequence here is that atoms are produced, they're dragged over in a magnetic trap, and they're transferred into an optical trap. And numbers are roughly that we have at present, we have tens of thousands of atoms produced at temperatures above and below the condensation temperature. These happen to be bosons. And they occupy, at this point, many lattice sites in this one-dimensional lattice that traps the atoms.
Who is the lattice?
So the optical lattice is here between the mirrors. And this is more than theorists need to know. There's light near the atomic resonance, which we use to probe the system. And there's light at a different frequency, which we use to stabilize the position of the mirrors. And they're stabilized to a separation which is stable to better than a picometer in order to remain on resonance. So that's what this feedback arrow indicates. But this same light that stabilizes the cavity is also the light which is the lattice light. So it's off resonant and it catches atoms, and atoms reside in there for a few seconds before they decay away. So we've done a couple of experiments. I mean, mostly just to let you know that we've started to do these experiments. The experiments have to do with cavity quantum electrodynamics with atoms that are in a trap. And I'll just describe them to you real briefly. Let's look at one particular potential well inside of our 1D optical lattice. The atoms are brought in, they're in the lowest band, they're pretty cold, so they're in the lowest band of that lattice. We just focus on that one dimension. And they're trapped to a dimension which is much smaller than an optical wavelength. So when they look at the cavity field, they see a particular value of the intensity of the field inside the cavity. So maybe the intensity is, here I've drawn it upside down, but here it's zero, here it's maximum, etc. So maybe the atoms are residing just at a point where the cavity field has its strongest gradient. Then one effect of sending light into the cavity is that the atoms may move. That is, when we start probing the system, we now build up an optical potential, which is just due to the probe light itself, and that optical potential can displace the atoms, and it does.
The light is off resonance.
The light that we're shining through the atoms is very far off resonance, yeah. Well, very, 100 gigahertz, somewhat far off resonance. Well, it turns out that this gives you a certain nonlinearity in your system, because the position of the atoms depends on how strongly you probe them, but the influence on the probe has to do with where the atoms are located in the cavity. So this is a typical condition in which you get nonlinear optics. The only thing that's kind of amusing here is that nonlinear optics occur at photon numbers in the cavity which are much, much smaller than one. So it's nonlinear optics at 1/100th of a photon, which is a little bit unusual, but it's totally above board. And it leads to bistability, like all nonlinear, well, like many nonlinearities do. And I think there's close connections to how people operate these bifurcation amplifiers in squids. These nonlinearities and these bistabilities can be used to perhaps enhance detection of cold atoms in the system, the same way it's been billed that bifurcation amplifiers can enhance detection of flux and of superconducting qubits inside of squid circuits. So there's kind of an intellectual connection between these two ideas. After all, they're both cavities, right? The squid circuit is an LC resonator, and this is an optical resonator, and they're very closely related. Anyhow, one also sees...
This displays will cause a shift, you say. But I get the main message of the last paragraph.
Yeah, it shifts the cavity resonance because...
So can it be controlled, or can you make it... Because there's always some shifts.
Yes, it can be controlled. But we'll talk about it some more. Okay, another effect of atoms interacting with the probe light is an incoherent one. You know, when you have 1/100th of a photon in the cavity, it's a little bit of a crime to talk about some average field which exerts some average force on the atoms. What actually is happening is that almost all the time the cavity is empty, and occasionally a photon comes in, resides there for about 1 microsecond, pushes the atoms quite hard because it's been enhanced by the cavity finesse, and then leaves. So the atom, aside from seeing an average force, is also being buffeted by large fluctuations in that force. And you can write down the fluctuations in the dipole force as you will. But you find kind of an interesting result when you examine this particular expression. So this relates more to atomic physics maybe than many body physics, but people for a long time have understood how atoms are heated as a result of their exposure to light. This is important because if you want to know how well laser cooling works, you have to know what is competing with your cooling. So in free space, it turns out that there are two reasons why atoms heat up, and they both have to do with spontaneous emission. One is that when an atom may spontaneously emit light and recoil as a result, and that recoil is random. And another thing is that when an atom spontaneously emits, the light forces on the atoms can fluctuate. It goes between dress states, if you will. Anyhow, in this rate of change of energy, or in the momentum diffusion, aside from a bunch of gobbledygook up front, that gives you something like 1. That's the free space result for heating of atoms in the presence of light. Inside of a cavity, you have to pay attention also to these force fluctuations in the atom due to fluctuations, quantum fluctuations of the photon field. And that leads to this piece over here. And you see that there's a cooperativity in this expression also. So there's two things that are of interest here. One is, this is a little bit of an odd result that really struck me as unusual. This is saying that at constant light intensity in the cavity, atoms are preferentially heated when the light also happens to be resonant with the cavity. Maybe this is actually fine in your eyes, but it certainly seemed unusual in my eyes. I figured that atoms seeing a certain intensity of light heat up by a certain amount. Doesn't matter whether that intensity of light is supported by a resonant or an off-resonant cavity. The fault with that line of thinking is that these, you know, what causes fluctuations of the photon field? Why does the photon field have noise at particular frequencies when you're just looking at a coherent state of light? Well, the reason is that a photon field is a coherent state of light in a particular mode on top of the vacuum in every other mode of the electromagnetic spectrum. And the noise that you see at some particular frequency is due to the beating of your coherent signal with vacuum fluctuations. Inside a high finesse cavity, the spectrum of the electromagnetic vacuum is changed. The vacuum fluctuations are enhanced on resonance and suppressed off resonance. And so you're able to measure these just by placing atoms in there that act as a kind of bolometer to sense those fluctuations directly.
You mentioned that you there's something that is surprising for you. I haven't really quite figured out. You said too fast. You say in vacuum, then no, I cannot reproduce it because I don't understand what surprises you.
This is a statement now about light, and this is a statement saying that at a constant intensity, the fluctuations around that intensity depend, of course, on the structure of the electromagnetic vacuum.
Right.
So when you see fluctuations in the intensity of light, what you're seeing is you're seeing a beating between your homodyne signal, which is your coherent state, and vacuum at some other field. So you're sensing the vacuum by beating it against something which amplifies the vacuum into some real noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so this expression is telling you that you can see that inside of a high finesse cavity, the electromagnetic
vacuum
is changed, which it should be. And the atoms sense that. Anyhow, that's maybe not surprising now that it's been explained. Okay. It has implications for these measurements, though, because heating, which seemed kind of arcane, is after all the destruction in these measurements. When you take atoms from a particular initial motional state and you heat them, then there's an uncertain number of atoms that move to a different motional state. That means that the atoms that you've examined are no longer the same atoms that you had probed. This is the noise. This means that you can't undo the measurement. You can't recombine two spin populations that had been individually counted because the spatial modes no longer overlap. Okay, so now this goes back to the idea of destruction, and we find that there should be a square root of n over here. Anyhow, there used to be this 1 over cn to the fourth power, and now it's dressed by all sorts of extra terms, which is the reality of making cavity-based measurements. And one finds, unfortunately, that now there's a source of heating which is also accentuated by the cavity. So you get enhanced sensitivity, but now there's heating which is even more enhanced than it would have been in free space. The free space line of argument sort of doesn't hold, and you're back to square one, which is to say you can't count at the Heisenberg limit. So you're kind of sunk. And there's some caveats in here. So, for example, you can trap your atoms very tightly so that they, in a trap which is much tighter than the cavity line width. You can place your atoms at specific positions in the cavity where you're not sensitive to their motion as much. So there's ways around it, but it certainly looks like it's a harder task than we had initially envisioned.
But there's an optimum C.
The optimum C is 1, and so you should never go to the strong coupling limit in this expression. And so, but again, there's the caveat. So, you know, you can go to where this is 0. There's other ways to suppress the noise also. This is noisier DC. You can look at very high frequency noise.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, we're measuring this heating pretty simply. The atoms in our optical trap are actually in a finite depth trap, and so they're constantly evaporating. And so if we add another source of heat, then that evaporation leads to, or the extra heat leads to an extra loss rate of atoms. And so we can directly measure this fluctuation of light inside of a cavity.
Couldn't you control the photon fluctuation by controlling the number by squeezing the atoms itself? To control number fluctuations? Would it be possible?
It's possible. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's possible to now do things to the light to squeeze it. I mean, that's one of the things that cavity QD has always been built as a way of modifying the photon statistics. So, okay, so we're measuring this heating, and it seems in accord with theory. We're also developing cavity QED that we want eventually to place onto atom chips. I don't know if people know what atom chips are, but they're basically handy little experimental platforms. And on the surface of a chip, one thinks of going then to the microfabrication facility at one's university and laying down a whole set of wires and widgets which implement a cold atom experiment. So what does this look like to you? To me, it kind of looks like a mesoscopic electronic circuit. And it looks to me that you have a paltry flux of atoms that is going to be sent through some kind of slalom course, which has features at interesting length scales, eventually maybe point contacts and quantum dots and things like that, Josephson junctions. And one eventually wants to measure either the current or the noise in the current that runs through these transport devices. So for the measure, these high finesse cavities are going to be quite useful because you should be able to, as Tillman has showed you, count with single atom precision, maybe destructively, but at least count and observe the flux of atoms through this transport circuit. So we've adopted a couple of methods to reducing cavity QED onto these high finesse, onto atom chips. Anyhow, there's just details here that maybe you don't have to go through, but it's pretty fun. You get to take cool pictures and learn about experimental techniques that you didn't know beforehand. But the experiment we're placing in the vacuum chamber right now is something like this, where you would produce a batch of cold atoms, you'd send them propagating along a waveguide, and we just want to be able to count them at two separate locations. And this would allow us to determine, for example, that the measurements that we make at the first location, for example, the arrival statistics of all the atoms, are actually non-destructive because the same beam is counted, is detected further downstream. So we should be able to develop out some ideas of quantum measurement using this device. Eventually, the atom chip will be technologically interesting enough that there's some quantum transport feature up here. But so far, most of the technologies haven't advanced that far. So except for maybe telling you about magnetization-sensitive imaging, but I can just leave that for later, I just want to thank you for your attention. Here's some of the folks that work in my research group and some of the places that give us money. Thanks. Yeah.
GBECI is a funding agency?
Guided BEC interferometers.
Is that funding agency?
No, that's DARPA.
A very basic question, but how do you relate to the problem of the friction of these atoms? How can they move? I mean, in the air, I understand with lasers, vacuum, but
on a chip. Oh, they're above the chip. They're in vacuum above the chip. So
why don't they fall?
Because you trap them. So, you know, there's magnetic traps, optical traps. There's ways to hold atoms in vacuum. And the idea with the atom chip is to make all that happen just off the surface of a chip. And the benefit of it is that you can create elements which are at relevant length scales to the problem. You can directly make little micron-wide barriers that would act as a Josephson junction or whatever. That's the idea. But also, you know, it allows far down the line, it allows the possibility of making much more complicated cold atom experiments, where a lot of devices are integrated, and also where feedback can be implemented so that the experiment can be changed in real time. So maybe you want to stabilize some feature of an experiment. You can measure some aspect of it while it's being continually run. You can perhaps replenish a beam of atoms continuously in one portion of the chip and send them down some other portion of the chip. It's like fusion, right? It's always been a decade away. If this technology does finally work out, then it's really a different paradigm for doing atomic physics. I don't build, you know, huge clumps, and a different for doing condensed matter physics too. I don't like stick everything. It's a massive doer. I really, on a chip, I just fabricate all the pieces and I concatenate them in a way that is interesting to me. Or even I reconfigure it on the fly.
Those wires you see on these chips are when we run one current through, there's a electric field and they build up a trap to trap atoms above it.
But in these chips, you can still interrogate them with laser fields, or still lock to lock it?
Yeah, well, at least, you know, the half plane is open, so you can do some stuff, or you can reflect light off. You know, some of the in situ imaging stuff, which requires light right next to the atoms, might be somewhat hampered by scattering off of the chip. That's just kind of a slight technical problem.
But the cooling is done outside the chip, and then you transfer the cold cloud into the chip?
Yeah. I think there would be techniques actually for cooling directly on the chip. So, for example, evaporative cooling happens on the chip. Mm-hmm. Everything except kind of the bulk laser cooling happens on the chip. People will probably also come up with, you know, cooling methods that are really specific to these chips. Most of it becomes greatly simplified. I mean, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Every lab that you go visit that operates one of these atom chips is as big and messy as my lab, right? So it's a little bit of hubris, really. But at some point, maybe this is how one, either you miniaturize the optical, the whole experimental setup, meaning that, I don't know, you could bring it to theory workshops and just do the experiments right here, you know, while I fly back home. That'd be nice. Or maybe, you know, you stick it on an airplane and you shoot down missiles.
Then, what's the efforts to make a non-magnetic chips?
I mean, non-magnetic chips?
I heard that at least at some point some people try to build micro mirrors. And because the question is whether can you set up something like optical things on a chip?
There's a number of people working on that. So it certainly would be pretty nice to be optically trapping atoms right above chips, and to be manipulating them around using some chip elements. Optics off of chips are never quite as good as currents on chips. That's just been the bane of the industry. But
also, it's less flexible, right? Or can you also make kind of structures at will?
To some extent, I've heard some people wanting to place holograms on the chip that can make even reconfigurable holograms on a chip that could make interesting optical potentials above the chip. So if you're really, these optical lattices that everybody's so happy about, they're actually kind of disappointing because it's just a square or it's some regular array of lattice sites. Wouldn't you like to have something where it's just really arbitrary how you've arranged things and lined things up? I mean, it's harder to compute, but in terms of a circuit, that's really what you want. But with light, that's actually pretty hard to do when you have optics that are very far away and they're just covering a very small solid angle. On a chip, though, especially if the hologram allows you to do it, you can have a very wide solid angle at your disposal, and so very small spatial features can be created. So there's people going in that direction. Yeah?
Okay, but this, for me, this information dates from a couple of years back, but one of the problems with the chip was that even with nanofabricated high-quality chip, the level of disorder on the wires, which then influence the atoms, is quite high. So what is the status on that?
It's about the same. Improve? It's about the same. I don't think it's really improved. Well, it's maybe improved slightly, but not tremendously. And it is going to be hard to get very close to these wires. That's what people are finding. And why do people want to get very close to the wires? One is to make the traps ever tighter. But you don't really want very tight traps for much of this. The real big reason is to make the feature length very small, right? That even if I have very small wires, if I stay an inch away from them, I only get an inch scale feature. If I want something like tunneling, that's difficult. So take something like rubidium, which is often people's atom of choice, and you just put in some reasonable experimental parameters over how much the height of a potential would likely vary, and you get a length scale out of that. Basically, over what length can I rely on a rubidium atom tunneling? Given my experimental realities, that length is just around 1 micron. So in optical traps where you have counterpropagating beams, you have sites a half micron apart, that's totally fine and all that physics flies. But get that close to an atom chip, your atoms sort of start disappearing if that chip is running current. So what's the solution? This RF method for making potentials is also very selective. So that's probably a sort of a knife that one could introduce to a lot of these potentials to make the narrow barriers, but stay away from wires. That, I think, is a good direction to go. And the other one is just to work with a lighter atom. So lithium would be much better for this than rubidium. Hydrogen would be even better.